I'm most grateful for the invitation. It's a great honor for me to be here. So my talk will be devoted to a microscopic scale wave particle duality, and this work was done in collaboration, constant collaboration with Emmanuel Faure, with whom all the work has been done. Suzy Protier and Antoine Heidi did a thesis on the subject, and these are other collaborators, the first two being postdocs. So the question that we'll ask is, can any of the phenomena that are well known in quantum mechanics exist in a classical, strictly classical experiment in a non-quantum system? So we were drawn into studying this question by chance, because we found a system in which a particle, actually a droplet of liquid, as I will show you, couples to a wave when you vibrate a substrate. So you have a liquid substrate, you vibrate it vertically, and the drop bounces on the substrate, generates waves, and couples to these waves. So I will first introduce the system. So you must excuse, it's an experimentalist talk. So, you know, experimentalists like to give details. So I will, the first part of the talk will be devoted to explaining the details of the experimental system. I hope it's not going to be too tedious. And then I will go to the properties, and then later on to a discussion to the possible relation with quantum mechanics. So my talk will be first introduce a system, then I will show that this couple system where you have the drop on the wave can walk straight, and I will look at the structure of the wave in that case. Then I will look at the properties that are observed when the system is forced to orbit, and then I will look at the properties that occur when the system is confined spatially. And then the discussion will effectively be related to the possible relation of this system to the quantum models of pilot waves. Okay, so the basic system is very simple. You have a vibration exciter. It could be a loudspeaker if you wish. You have a small cup here containing silicon oil. You deposit on the top of this bath a small drop of oil, the same oil, and if it is well tuned, the oil drop will bounce on the surface and will not coalesce with the surface ever. So I will show you this by films, and I will discuss most of the basic properties showing you films. So I will first show you a film on the bouncing of the drop. So this it's a slow motion of the bouncing. The real bouncing occurs at 80 hertz, 50 hertz. The drop size is about 1 millimeter. This is both silicon oil. And as you see, the drop bounces steadily, generating waves. The trick is that when the drop touches the surface, there is an air film between the drop and the surface. And this film doesn't have time to break before the drop lifts again. And therefore, you renew the air film, then it falls on the surface again, crushes the film, but never has time to break. So you can keep these drops bouncing for days if you wish. It's a stable system. Okay, so this is the basic. As you have seen, there are waves being generated in this process, but nothing very spectacular. Actually, these waves are sufficient if you put several drops of this type on the same bath. They will attract each other, and then they will form this. So that's a sort of crystal of drops. It's a triangular crystal. So the trick is that each drop is only stable in position when it bounces on the surface in a place where the surface is horizontal at the time it touches the surface. So this means that there is a spacing here between the drop, which is related to the surface wave. I can show you again if you just. And you see the drops are not exactly equal in size, but this doesn't matter because what counts is the wavelength on the surface. So this is not what I'm going to talk about, I'm sorry, but the thing I'm going to talk about is what happens when you increase the amplitude of the forcing. When you increase the amplitude of the forcing, and that was we observed by chance, and this brought us to study this system. So this is a cell seen from above. It's about this is about 15 centimeters. This is real time now. And as you see, the drop moves at constant velocity on the surface with its wave. And it bounces on the wall and does some kind of, if you wish, a sort of billiard motion. So again, this is real time. So this means the drop moves at about 1 to 2 centimeters per second. So it's, you know, you can see the experiments, it's very easy. So we saw this phenomenon and wondered why. That's how we came to spend 5 years of our time later on studying this this problem. Okay, so just let me show you why this occurs. So this is a same regime of walking droplets taken with a fast camera, so it's a slow movie. The whole talk won't be movies, I reassure you. As you can see, the drop generates waves, but there is a symmetry breaking, and the drop doesn't fall on the top of the wave that's generated at last bounce. It falls on the forward front. So this, I'll show you again. Well, maybe I'll show you a scene from above. And you see the same thing. The drop, the symmetry is broken in the sense that the drop always falls on the forward front of the bump that it has generated at the previous bounce. And this gives an iterative motion by which the drop moves at constant velocity. So the velocity is about a tenth of the velocity of the wave. Okay. Okay, so I will just show you two things I'm not going to talk about either, which has the same problem of interaction between two drops. If you put them on the surface when in the walking regime, what do they do? So you have two regimes, two possible collisions. So you have two identical drops walking at the same velocity, and you have them collide with an impact parameter. And as you've seen, they repelled each other. They repelled each other even though they never touched each other. They repelled each other through their interaction by the waves. So that's one of the regime. And the other regime that we observe, just changing the impact parameter, is this. And as you see, in this case, the drops get an orbiting motion. And in fact, these orbits have a diameter which is related to wavelengths emitted on the surface. So we studied these orbits, but I'm not going to talk about them. Yes, of course.
Angular box, right?
Yes.
How will it change? Is it depending on this boundary?
No. This phenomenon doesn't depend on the boundary. I will show you what happens when you have interaction with the boundary later on. It's far from the boundary. I can tune what length scale the wave field has. I can maybe show you a last thing about this, where you can see you walk far from any boundary in a very big box. And you see that you can have a very large field. Okay. This is tunable. Okay, so I will have to go into a little bit more detail. So I have many parameters in the system. I block most of them. I use always the same oil. I always work with air, in air. And I always force the oscillation at fixed frequency. Now, this being said, it remains two variables, the size of the drop and the acceleration of the oscillation. So I have to go into this detail because it's necessary for. So this is the acceleration, the amplitude of the oscillating acceleration. When it's below one, it's in unit of g. So when it's below one, the drop breaks and coalesces with a bath. In all this region, the drop bounces. And here, you have the threshold of the Faraday instability. So I must tell you a little bit about the Faraday instability. If you force a fluid vertically at a, with a periodic forcing, you have a threshold over which the surface of the fluid gets spontaneously unstable and covered with surface waves. This phenomenon was discovered by Faraday, first on sand and then on normal liquid. And you see a pattern which is usually related to the size and shape of the cell. And you have standing waves over this threshold. So it's a parametric forcing, which is quite similar to parametric forcing of a pendulum. And motion is given by Mathieu's equation. This means, being a parametric forcing, this means that the frequency of the waves are half the frequency of the forcing. Okay. So this will, returning to this, you can see that now if I consider the bouncing of the drop bounces normally in this region. Then when the amplitude of forcing is increased, there is a period doubling by which the bounces become unequal. If it is a small drop, it is the precursor of a Feigenbaum cascade driving to a chaotic motion, chaotic vertical motion of the drop. But there is a range of value for which the bouncing becomes subharmonic, entirely subharmonic, meaning that the drop touches the surface once in two periods. And that's very nice, because as it touches the surface once in two periods, it is a subharmonic, so it has the same frequency as the Faraday waves. So this means that the drop becomes an emitter of Faraday wave. It has the right frequency. And this Faraday wave, since you are very near to the threshold, these Faraday waves are sustained, not completely sustained, but they have a decay time which is long, and therefore they have large amplitude. And this is why the drop in this yellow region starts walking. It starts walking because it's able to generate waves of large enough amplitude. Okay, so this is the period doubling of the time. This time, this is the height. This is the bouncing of the drop in before period doubling, during period doubling, when the period doubling is complete. And at that point, the drop starts walking, moving. Okay, so this is a simple model for this bifurcation. So that was done with Areski Boudaoud. It's a very simplified model, but it works very well. So I will show you. How do you go from this regime to this regime? How do you break this symmetry? So the model that we tried is the following. You just disregard the oscillation, disregard what happens, the fluid dynamics of the system, which is very complicated. You just say that you look at the horizontal motion. And you said that the horizontal motion is driven by the collisions with the waves, and it's damped by the viscous friction due to air friction. Okay, so you have this term contains the kick that the drop receives at each collision. And it contains also the mean slope of the wave and the time of the collision. And this term contains the ratio of the velocity of the drop over the velocity of the wave. So this gives you the phase shift between the motion of the drop and the motion of the wave. So this could be zero. And as you see, it's a sine here. So you can check that these two terms are the same order of magnitude. And then you check, you seek a steady solution with constant velocity. So you write that this is zero. And you expand the sign, which gives you a first order term and a third order term. And you have a bifurcation equation, which concerns the velocity of the drop. For low value of this parameter, you have only one solution, which is stable, where the drop bounces on the spot. And then when you pass a certain threshold of amplitude of the wave, then the drop starts moving either to the left or to the right in this 1D system. In reality, it moves in any direction. But when the symmetry is broken, the drop then keeps moving straight. Okay, the orders of magnitude are right. And with this comparison of the model with the experiment, in the experiment, it depends on the size of the drop. And in fact, a more complete model has been done by Jan Mrlášek and John Bush very recently. Yes, of course. As many questions as you like. Not only you, but.
I was wondering, so it's what is the ratio between the amplitude of the wave compared to the depths?
Depth, it's not shallow water, is the question. Usually the depth is about 5 millimeters and the amplitude of the wave is less than 0.2 millimeter.
And if you increase the depth, it changes?
It doesn't change.
It doesn't.
You can reduce the depth, in which case it shifts the Faraday threshold. And I actually will use this trick when I want to avoid the waves in a certain region of the surface. Yes?
So what's your control parameter now?
The control parameter, experimental control parameter, is tuning of the amplitude
of
the forcing.
Of the wave?
Sorry?
Amplitude.
It's an indirect control of the wave. Because it tunes you at different distances from the Faraday instability threshold. So we'll return to that. So the energy balance is interesting because, okay, so especially if you want to compare it to, so of course it is a very dissipative system. But it is a strange system in the sense that you provide energy to this system in a sort of equal way because you kick the drop vertically. So you provide energy to the drop. And you also provide energy to the wave because you are very near the Faraday instability threshold where the wave would be sustained. So you provide energy to both components of the system. Actually, that's very important in the trick. Okay, so in fact, the main limitation for this experiment is you work at constant frequency, so the equivalent of energy is fixed. Okay, so now I'm coming to my talk. That's the beginning of my talk. you have this object, which is formed of a drop, which is 1 millimeter in size. And you have a wave packet, which can be 10 to 20 centimeters in extent. And the question is, how can they are linked together, they move together, they live together, and how can they have a common dynamics? Because the wave is scattered, the drop is point-like, it's not going to break, and the drop has to follow the wave in some way. So what happens if you divide the wave? If you diffract the wave, if you do something to the wave. So I will first discuss the trivial case where the walker walks straight, because this will turn necessary to understand what happens when you have it rotate or when you have it interact with boundaries. Okay, so walking straight. So I will show you that this wave structure contains what we call a past memory. So this. The aspect of the wave field of the same drop for three forcing amplitude. If you remember this phase diagram, we are moving here with the same drop, and you look at the system in A, B, and C. So this is far from Faraday instability threshold. This is nearer, and this is very close to Faraday instability threshold. The velocity of the drop is almost the same, but as you see, the wave field is quite different. Here it's approximately circular. Here it has a sort of horseshoe shape. And here it has a very complex interference structure in the wake. This is what I'm going to describe in more detail, because it turns out to be very important. These are measurements of the way so this is a bit flashy color. Sorry, but we have a system by which we can measure, so we're very proud of it. You know, we are experimentalists, so we're very proud we can measure something. You know, so these are measurements of the surface shape. And the accuracy is very good. You can get down to less than a micron in precision. And as you see again, the wave structure has a complex structure. at the back. Okay, so the idea is that the wave is generated by the drop, and is generated by the drop during its repeated bouncing on the surface. So what would be the wave generated by one bounce of the drop? So this I don't know what to do. So instead of doing one bounce, I take a small steel sphere, and I drop it in the bath to look at what happens. So I drop it from very small height, so that I'm almost reproducing what happens with a drop. And I can show you, well, I have time, actually. I will show you the film. So first case is, so these are measurements again. So you will see the shape of the surface with an amplification of the wave in a case where the surface does not vibrate. So you just drop, it's just the standard experiment where you drop a stone in a pond. Okay, so here you see this wave propagating out and damping away. That's exactly what you would get when you throw a stone in a pond. Now I'll show you the same recording, but in a case where you oscillate the surface near the Faraday instability threshold. Oh, no, sorry. You should have made a mistake. Okay. So initially, it's the same, exactly the same wave. But you see this propagative wave leaves behind a pattern of standing waves. These are Faraday waves that are left behind. And they damp very slowly. Actually, the damping time depends on the distance of Faraday threshold. So you can keep them for a few seconds, for instance, 40, 80 cycles. OK, so this is what I've shown here. And this is without vibration. This is with vibration. What I'm going to show you is the evolution of this line, this cross section of the surface, as a function of time in this case and in this case. So it's a spatial-temporal pattern. And okay, so this is without periodic forcing, and this is with periodic forcing. This is a propagative wave. So I remind you, this is just a spatial temporal representation. This is time going down. Space is here. And you see this propagative wave moving out in the first case. And in the second case, you see that the same propagative wave leaves behind a pattern of standing waves. And these are the Faraday waves that are going to survive for some time. OK, so you this. The fact that we understood this was enabled us to do a numerical simulation of the whole system. So you have a simulation of the complete dynamics of the walker. So that was mainly done by Emmanuel Faure. So you assume, so you have to simulate two things. You have to simulate the motion of the droplet and the motion of the wave. So and the wave field. So for the motion of the droplet, you just assume that it bounces on the surface, and it bounces on the surface, and the next displacement of the droplet will depend on the local slope that it will meet when it collides with the surface. Now, this local slope you compute by superposing all the waves generated at previous impacts. So you have to look at the wave pattern resulting from all this collision with the interface. So if you do that kind of simulation, so these are the details. This is the height of the liquid, which results from this summation, where you have two damping terms, one as a function of time, one as a function of space, that do not coincide. And I can explain why if someone is interested. In any case, with this simulation, you recover the fact that the drop can start walking spontaneously. So you recover the the transition, and you also recover a very realistic wave field. Now, this wave field, it's worth. So, what is the structure of a wave field? Well, this wave field results from sources of waves that are aligned here. So, I don't know, in France, we are taught, because we are in a country of Fresnel, you know, so so we have to in university, we are taught Fresnel diffraction. An interesting situation is Fresnel diffraction behind a wall. So, you have a wall, you have this is represented here, yeah. You have a wall, you have behind this, you have a plane wave coming to this wall. And the idea is that all the points that are on the wall, nothing happens, nothing, the wave comes from one direction. And all the points that are near the wall, you can replace the wave, the plane wave, by a series of sources, virtual sources of circular waves. And thus you compute all the wall wave field. And it's the same wave field that we observe here, exactly the same. And I can show you this. This is in the limit of infinite memory. That means that all the points that have been visited in the past keep emitting waves. You get this structure, which is comparable to this. So in fact, this is a Fresnel interference pattern. So it's very simple, as long as a walker walks straight. But you see that this same rule, that all the points that have been visited in the past emit waves, will make things very complicated if the trajectory is not straight. So this is what I'm going to study now. Okay, so the first thing that you can do is what happens if you manage so that the particle, the drop, has an orbiting motion, so moves on a circle. So you have to apply an external force. And there's two ways of doing that experimentally. So you know we are experimentalists, so we want to apply a force. You can either charge the drop and put in a magnetic field. It's feasible, but it's not very reliable because it's difficult to charge a drop in a reliable way, and it's also difficult to have it bouncing when it's charged. And the other way is to have it on a rotating substrate and to use Coriolis forces. So there is formal analogy between the two systems, and the equivalent of Larmor angular velocity is 2 omega. So meaning that if you in a rotating frame of reference, a moving particle will have a circular orbit with a frequency angular velocity 2 omega, and the orbit radius is this. So this, the experimentalists tend to be lazy. This is complicated and difficult to set up, so this is easier. So we chose this solution. And we put this experiment up. So you just have the same shaker. You have a cell, but now the cell rotates at constant velocity and tunable constant velocity. So the surface, of course, is in a parabolic shape. This doesn't matter because if you have a drop, a motionless drop, it will remain motionless because there will be equilibrium between, there will be a centripetal force, if you wish, that makes it rotate. So it will be motionless in the frame of reference. Now, if the drop moves spontaneously, if it's a walker, then it has its own velocity. Then it will be submitted to Coriolis force. And indeed, what you find is that you have trajectories that look like this in the laboratory frame. But then you can go to the rotating frame, and you check that indeed the drop rotates on an orbit with a radius that you can measure, the diameter that you can measure. Okay. Now, this radius, if you believe in classical physics, should vary like v over 2 omega. So it should vary as when you increase the angular velocity. The radius of the orbiting should decrease like this. So let me show you the film. What you see actually is this. You see the tank is rotating one direction. The drop orbits the other direction. That's because in Coriolis force is a minus sign. And you can measure this orbital motion. And as you can see, the main thing to notice, I will show you the next film, which is for a larger velocity. And the main thing to be noticed is that you have a strange wave field. You have a recoiled wave field. Okay, the wave field is sort of curved on itself. And that's the main effect. Oh, sorry. So now you measure, you can tune, as you must remember that I can tune the memory. Either I can be far from in Faraday instability threshold or near the Faraday instability threshold. In the first case, the waves are localized. In the second case, they have memory. So in the first case, this is what you see. So there is a shift due to the existence of the waves, but you recover the classical law. Now, if you tune so that the memory is strong, then you get this, which means that the possible orbits have now discrete radii. And when you increase the velocity, you see jumps from one possible orbit to the next. Okay, so you repeat the experiment by varying wavelengths, velocity, the angular velocity of the tank, and you get these results, which you want to rescale. You want to compare it. So this is a picture of the first orbits. And the question, of course, is can this be compared? You know, there's a similarity between rotation of magnetic field. So can this be compared to lambda levels? Can this be compared to quantization that you have in quantum mechanics? So in quantum mechanics, as you know, if you put a magnetic field, you have orbits. These orbits obey Bohr-Sommerfeld condition. And this gives them a Larmor radius, which is quantized, and which has this expression. So, of course, there is no direct comparison possible with our system, because here you have H. And of course, we don't have Planck constant in our system. But in fact, when you think in our system, we have a wavelength. And in quantum mechanics, you have de Broglie wavelengths. So you can compare the two systems by expressing the Larmor radius of the orbits. Instead of expressing it as a function of H, you express it as a function of de Broglie wavelengths. And you get another expression, which is here, which is the same as this one. And then you remember that you must go from magnetic field to rotation. And this means to change this into this. And the question is, after all these bold hypotheses, can you this would suggest that in our experiment, the radii should vary like this, should discrete radii should be like this. And so this works in the sense that you do recover that the observed radii are discrete and have the same scaling as in quantum mechanics. Difference is a difference in the prefactor. And the prefactor should be square root of 1 over pi, corresponding to the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. And we have this. So in fact, it turns out that we can recover the same result in a numerical simulation. So in numerical simulation, you do the same assumption that you have secondary sources on the circle. If you have a short memory, you have only a few sources here. But if you have a long memory, it means that you have secondary sources of waves aligned all along the circle. And this will create a wave field. And you have to compute what is the effect of this wave field at the point where the particle bounces. So this will give a slanted surface, and this slanted surface will correct the effect of the radius of the orbit. So first, this type of numerical simulation, you recover exactly the structure of the wave field that you observe. And secondly, this is the detail of the calculation. You can compute the slope, the radial slope, under the drop at the point where it bounces. And you find that as a function of the velocity of the rotation velocity, it does this slanted shapes there. And this creates an additional force. And this additional force adds to the Coriolis force. And the result is that in the numerical simulation, you recover exactly the steps that you have observed in the experiment. OK, so this is first result. Now I will show you what happens in other types of situation where you have a confinement of the particle, so that the particle is either enclosed in cavities. So this will answer your question about what happens if the cell is not large enough. Or else, when you force the wave particle object to pass through slits. So these are both obviously inspired by quantum mechanics. So I will show first the effect of confinement in the coral. And this probably is the most remarkable result. I'll show you first. So this is what is white here is a cavity. It's a submarine cavity. So it means that in this region, the thickness of oil is only 1 millimeter. And therefore, the Faraday instability threshold is much higher. And this is never covered with waves. And these walls act as a repellent to the walker. So as you will see, this is a walker with weak memory, so very far from instability from Faraday threshold. And what you see, it's a rather trivial trajectory where the walker is repelled by the boundaries. So that's not so spectacular. Now we'll show you exactly the same drop, same cavity. But when you are very near to the Faraday instability threshold. So then, this is the trajectory that you observe. So you see that all the waves that are present in the cavity are due to the motion of the droplet. They have all been generated by the droplet. But of course, they have a memory, because they're sustained. And therefore, the superposition is a very complex wave field. This wave field drives the particle. So the particle has a complex trajectory. And having a complex trajectory also generates a complex wave field. So there's a feedback between a complex wave field and a complex trajectory. And the whole thing becomes, as you see, chaotic. This is what you have seen. And this, all these waves again are due to the bouncing. If the drop breaks, all the waves disappear. So we have been in competition with John Bush in MIT to do this statistics of occupancy by the drop of the cavity. So we did it in a rectangular cavity, and he did it in a circular cavity. I will present both results. So you chose a rectangular cavity of this type, which is resonant at the frequency of the Faraday wave, and which has this eigen mode. Then you have this particle moving in a complicated way in the cavity, and you look at the probability of visit of the cavity along this axis. And what you find is that indeed, you have maximum of probability of presence in those regions where you have eigenmodes, where you have the antinodes of the eigenmode. And the reason is that it's actually intuitive. The bouncing of the drop generates Faraday wave. These Faraday waves are sensitive to the shape of the cavity. And since they accumulate, they form obstacles to the propagation of the particle, and therefore the particle stays longer in the antinodes of the. So this was our results, and John Bush's results are. So you can do the numerical simulation by adding reflected wave. Sorry, I missed. Oh, don't necessarily disappeared. Sorry for that. Anyway, there's another. John Bush has obtained the same result in a circular cavity. And it's even, I will show you because it will come later in the talk again. And you find exactly the same result that the maximum of, if you look at the occupancy profile in a cavity, it reproduces the eigenmode of the cavity. Now, next experiment is to look at the diffraction or interference of the these walkers. So it's again the same problem. You have an extended wave. You have a point-like particle. You disturb the wave by having it diffracted through a slit. And you look at what happens to the particle. So I don't know if this is very clear. These gray regions here are underwater walls, where the waves don't propagate. So you have this square cavity. You leave the walker from this corner. It walks towards the slit here, and then moves on the other side of the slit. And the question is, where does it walk? And I can show you the film. You see here it has been almost straight. But you see that the wave is, you see it has been deflected and then it moves away. And so you repeat this experiment over and over again. Maybe one more. Okay, so let's do that. Okay, so when you do this, you see that as the walker comes near the slit, it's deviated even before reaching the slit. Then it's deviated while it passes the slit. And then finally, it recovers a straight walk when it's far away. So what you can measure is the deviation as a function of the parameter of impact. Where has it crossed the slit? And you look at if there is some regularity in that, and you find that there is none. This is the angle of deviation, and this is the position at which it has crossed the slit, and you see that for similar trajectories, initial trajectory, you can be deviated either to the left or to the right. But then if you repeat the experiment over and over again with the same drop, the single drop experiment is a single drop because it's always the same that you pass back and forth. You record these trajectories and you look at the histograms and you find that indeed there is a regularity in the histogram and the probability of deviation in a direction, a given direction, is related to the diffraction of a plane wave that would have the same wavelength through the same slit. There is a difference with quantum mechanics, though, because in quantum mechanics, it's linked with the intensity of the wave. Here it's the modulus of the amplitude of the wave. But otherwise, when you change, for instance, here, we change the frequency, and you see that there's a change of the diffraction pattern. Yes?
What's the speed of the particle compared to the speed of the wave?
About a tenth.
So the wave can hit the wall behind it.
Of course,
come back again.
The wave hits the wall before and brings in back information to the particle.
Even after it's crossed the hole.
Yeah, after it has
the
crossed.
The ongoing wave will bounce and come back again.
Yeah, we manage that the walls of the cells are far away, are far enough. But the walls of the slit, of course, plays this role that you described. So but in the end, the particle will become will have a straight motion again.
Sorry, I didn't hear the difference from the quantum picture. Did you say that again?
And is that the here you see I have fitted? I mean, there's no reason why they should be should fit. I mean, it's just a guide for the eye. But this is the modulus of the amplitude of the diffracted wave, whereas in quantum mechanics is the intensity. Okay, so, but you see that, so this is exactly recovered in numerical simulation, yes?
Yeah, you're comparing a plane wave in this case in quantum mechanics, whereas this is not a plane wave.
That's actually very important. I will discuss this in the end. Yeah, in the experiment, there's no plane wave. So, but you see the importance, for us, why is this result important is that we have not measured anything concerning the wave. The measurements concern the particle. So we have diffracted the wave, but we have deviated the particle. So what we have measured is a probability of deviation of the particle. So it means that the passing of in this object, passing through a slit, has generated an uncertainty. You have tried to localize the particle by passing it through the slit, and by doing so, you have generated an uncertainty on its transverse velocity. I don't say monomomentum because I don't know exactly what the mass is. Okay.
If you were able to control two successive marches of the drop identically coming on the one side, would they always come out the same way on the other side?
In this experiment doesn't have the precision that, you know, it's fluid mechanics. It's not within the precision of this experiment, you don't get the same deviation. You have it's extremely sensitive to the
initial condition.
It's so sensitive that you. It's like any chaotic process. In fact, the trajectory in the slit region is quite complex. And that's what you recover in numerical simulation, where you get this deviation as a function when you send them with very near impact parameter. So you see again the same phenomenon. So you can then do the double slit experiment, which is supposed to be strictly limited to quantum mechanics. And Feynman wrote this thing. It says that the phenomenon that is impossible, absolutely impossible, to explain in a classical way. The double slit experiment for a single particle. As you know, you all know this experiment, which has been done with photons, with electrons. And of course, the paradox is that in quantum mechanics, you cannot measure both by which slit the particle has passed and the diffraction pattern. In this experiment, well, you can do it. And of course, you see very clearly that the drop has passed either to the left or to the right. But still, when you do the histogram of the deviation, you find that there are two directions in this case where it doesn't like to go. And in this system, it's very simple to explain. There's no sort of miracle. The drop impinges on the two slits, send ahead of itself waves that pass through the slit and that guide it. And the waves, you can see, they pass through both slits. And therefore, they guide the particle, which, and in fact, when you when the particle leaves from far away from the slit, from far away, you don't know through which slit it's going to pass because it's deviated before the slit even. So it sort of wiggled and goes through one slit, then moves out. And so in a way, in our system, there's no mystery. So I will go very briefly through this. We did a sort of analogous of tunneling. Always the same idea. Yes, sorry.
You have a film of the double slit experiment?
Yeah. if you ask. It's not a very good film, though. The lighting is not very good.
Question?
Yes?
This is the probability that it's the wall.
Sorry?
The probability that it's the particle it's the wall.
It's the wall. We didn't measure, but there is a non-zero, of course. And even in the single slit, you have cases where the particle goes towards the slit and doesn't pass through. It's reflected. So it's the wall situation is not so... Because a very important thing is that you have waves way ahead of the particle and, of course, way behind. Yes?
I was wondering, because the wall, right, is not going out of the fluid.
No.
Why?
Because otherwise you have meniscus, and meniscus is too violent a disturbance.
So what if you vary, what determines the height of the variable?
Well, you do it empirically so that the Faraday wave, that you check that the walker is repelled by the wall. And this is linked with the fact that Faraday instability threshold is very far, because you have 1 millimeter. So it means that you would have to have an acceleration maybe 10 times larger to get Faraday instability over the wall. No, is it not clear? No. Yes?
Have you studied the dependence on the thickness of the wall?
On the thickness of the wall, no.
I mean, it's a very thick gap through which...
Yeah, it is again. Yeah, we have not... We have... It has to be... in our case, we have not studied it. Not really. Not seriously. It's of order of magnitude of one wavelength.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm wondering what would happen if it were
order,
much, much smaller than a wavelength.
It could be... I think it would work with smaller walls, thinner walls. But I will show you that with thin walls, you have a chance of tunneling. Yes.
So how important is it that the particle feeds back on the wave? If I took a dead fly and put it on this wave,
no, but
it get carried by the wave, and the wave is an interference pattern. It may end up here and there.
Yeah, but here the drop, the at each bounce, the drop probes the surface.
Yeah.
And the next jump of the drop is entirely determined by the local slope of the surface. Mm-hmm. And this is a feedback of the wave field onto the drop. That's why you have to. When you compute this trajectory, you have to superpose all the waves, compute the local slope, and then the drop goes.
Right. It's very non-local evolution in time because it remembers
exactly.
Everything from the
before. Exactly. That's the main message of my talk is that these objects have what we call past memories. They have in their wave field a memory of their past trajectory. Yes.
Did we get the differential equation for this Faraday wave? Is it similar to the Schrödinger equation for a generic system?
Not really, no. No. What I will show, no, what is, what John Bush actually is working on that, so you should invite him. He's working on the analogy that there is between Schrödinger equation and fluid dynamics. Equation, and you can indeed, from Schrödinger equation, do the Madelung transform, and you get equations which are close to the conservation equation and close to Euler equation, with an additional term which is similar to surface tension. But that doesn't mean that it's in a way it's not. I will answer this question later on.
So there's also a term containing memory that in your the last description just now.
In the numerical simulation, no, I mean, for as far as I know, there's no theoretical model at all in statistical physics of a system which has this kind of past memory. That's why I enjoyed giving this talk, because I think it's an interesting problem that this system with past memory, they tend to generate chaos. And we believe that this chaos is responsible for probabilities that look like quantum probabilities.
But how long is the Nolmarkovian?
Sorry?
How long is the Nolmarkovian property? Can you approximate it like quasi-Markovian?
How long is the memory?
The memory, that's right.
The memory is tunable. In the case that you have shown, that we have seen here, memory is about the last 50 bounds. 50 bounds. It means 1 second, you know, 1 second memory typically, with the scale that you've seen. So it means that you have really, there is a limitation. We can't go too far, because if we go too far, then the cell is too small. We have limited size of the cell. Otherwise, we would like to go, of course, further. But you have to have to be able to be sure that there is no interaction with the wall. Yes?
Apropos of the thickness of the slit question, do you have a sense of, in the double slit experiment, for example, which parts of reflections from which parts of the structure are responsible for guiding the particle through the slits? Is it from the walls of the slit?
In the numerical model, we replace the wall by point-like objects, and they sort of re-emit the waves that they receive, and that's good enough to get this same phenomenon. Okay, so you must deduce this from my time.
Okay. You have an image of the
moment.
Do you have an image?
I have an image here, yeah. Okay. Okay, so, I can show you again a film. Okay, so we did experiments that were aimed at looking at sort of pseudo tunnel effect. What happens if instead of dividing the wave by passing it through the slit, you divide it by having part of a wave transmitted through a wall and part of the wave reflected? Where does the particle go? So I will show you. This I will not describe completely. I will just give you an idea of what happens. So again, this is the same kind of film that you have seen. It's a submarine frame, and this is very thick. The waves are reflected, and in this case, the walker has no chance to escape. Okay, what happens if you have thin walls? I'll do exactly the same experiment. And you see the trajectory looks very much the same. You have the same type of reflection. But the difference is that you see that the waves sort of leak out. A part of the wave goes on the other side of the boundaries. And the question is, does it give the droplet a chance to get out? And so you have to wait a little bit. But it's well tuned, you see. And out it goes. Okay, so again, so we'll just give you a flavor of this experiment. Again, So Antonin Eddy, who was a PhD student who studied that, had to be very patient because he had to do statistics, you know. And that was very serious. And in fact, you do find that you have an exponentially decreasing chance of crossing depending on the thickness of the wall. And the interesting point is not that. The interesting point is that why is it some random phenomenon? And here you see, if you have thick wall, the trajectories are entirely deterministic. you have no chance of getting out at all. If you have thin walls, then each collision here becomes a little bit ill-defined. And here they become even more ill-defined. And the trajectory, even though it looked, as you have seen, not very different, becomes much more irregular, leading to collision with the walls that are different, that are more at right angle. And these lead to an escape. So in fact, the escape is linked with the wall thing. Therefore, the time delay in exiting. OK, so we did this also. These are the measurements. I'm sorry for Antonin to pass through quickly on 1 year of work. We did it in this geometry also to check that it works also with normal incidence. It works. OK, I'll skip that. OK, now the last experiment that we're doing is propagation in a random medium. So we have this sort of array of needles. And you just want to see what happens if you put the, so this when it's not in the cell, it's just to show you what it looks like. You put it in the cell, you look at the propagation of a walker. Okay, so I will show you first with weak memory. So you see that there's a meniscus around each needle, so you can see this. So you see the walker has this sort of random motion, nothing special to mention. Now, if you increase the memory again, always the same trick, then you find that trajectory, initially it looks the same, but you will see that there's a few differences. You see this? It starts doing small orbits spontaneously. OK, so this is not so spectacular in this particular example, but I will show you a trajectory where it was even larger memory. We recorded here only the trajectory, not the wave. And you can see. You see, that's kind of it's this form of localization. And these small orbits are due to the waves. And they are the tightest orbits that we have seen in the rotating system.
But the whole lattice is also vibrating.
Yeah, the whole thing is vibrating. As you, otherwise, you don't have the drop. So you have no choice for this, unfortunately. So, OK. So now, OK, you have seen this. OK, now I'm coming to the important part of the talk. So is there a relation with quantum mechanics? So it's OK, we have a particle which is driven by a wave. So it's very reminiscent of the models of quantum mechanics, pilot wave models of quantum mechanics. And there are two. So these pilot wave models are a bit old-fashioned. There were two models. One initially proposed by De Broglie in 1926, and one that was, which is due to David Bohm in 1952. And even though they are known now as De Broglie-Bohm models of pilot waves, they are completely different from each other. And that is actually quite surprising because it's quite obvious when you read what they have done. So I will treat them in reverse order. I will first tell you a little bit about Bohm's model. Well, probably you know more than I do, but Bohm's model is precisely taking the Schrödinger. So in Bohm's model, Bohm thought that the Schrödinger equation is the equation of the pilot wave. And so he tried to find what are the trajectories that are generated by Schrödinger equation. So he does this Madelung transform by writing that the wave function is under this shape. You get two equations. One is a continuity equation, and one is this other equation in where this term can be a sort of equivalent to a capillary term anyway. And when you solve it to find you can do some manipulation, and you get finally an equation of motion. So this equation of motion is strictly derived from Schrödinger equation, so it's perfectly valid. And Bohmian mechanics consists in solving the Schrödinger equation in that way and looking at these trajectories in physical space. The only problem is that, okay, so when Bohm came out with this model, De Broglie wrote this. It's a very French aristocrat, very polite. He says it's very interesting, but since it regards the way psi as a physical reality, it's not acceptable because what he had in mind was completely different. So in fact, in Bohm approach, you start from Schrödinger equation, you look for a trajectory, and therefore what you get is this trajectory, but it's a trajectory of probabilities. It's not a trajectory of a particle. And in that regard, it's different from De Broglie, because what De Broglie had in mind was a double solution where you have two ways. Well, I will come to that. I will just show you first work of De Broglie. First work of De Broglie, very famous, where he introduced this De Broglie wavelengths. And he had this idea of having this strictly relativistic theory. And he said, you know, the particle has to be surrounded by standing wave in the frame of reference of the particle. And that will give it a sensitivity to obstacles, for instance, or to things that are remote. And he said, okay, so the standing wave is formed of a divergent wave plus a convergent wave. And he said there is a little, so the divergent wave you can consider as being emitted by the particle. And you have to assume that there is a convergent wave that comes from infinity and that converges to the particle. So he said that there is an interesting philosophical issue about this wave coming from infinity to converge to the particle. But in fact, in our system, it's not so surprising. If you remember the system that we have this bouncing of the drop, this time, this space, this one bounce. One bounce emits a wave, and this wave generates standing wave behind. So everything occurs as if the particle emitted one wave moving out, and if the wave front emitted a wave backward, the two forming a standing wave. So the converging wave doesn't come from infinity. It comes from the outer front of the disturbed region. Okay. So okay. So now De Broglie, there was a very complicated story because he was involved in the Solvay conference and that he was defeated during the Solvay conference by the Copenhagen people. And he sort of conceded that maybe this pilot wave could be Schrödinger equation. And this was the starting point of Bohm later on. But in fact, then he returned to his initial idea. In his initial idea, he had what he called a double solution. There were two solutions. One wave, so his aim was to understand trajectory of real particles in physical space. So he thought the real particle is associated with a wave which has a singularity at its center and which travels with it, which has a trajectory. This is the pilot wave. And then the other wave is the Schrödinger wave and represents the probabilities. So he said there must be the two types of waves. Okay, so these are the expression of waves, and the velocity of this particle was given by gradient of the phase. So in fact, if you reconsider our experiment, in a way, it suggests a sort of implementation of De Broglie's idea. Because if you look at one trajectory of our wave-particle association, when you look at the passage of thing passing through the slit, you have a real particle associated with a standing wave that moves through the slit and doesn't look at all like a plane wave. But if you do the statistics, then what you see is that the statistics look as if you had had a plane wave crossing the slit. So in a way, this is the first wave of De Broglie, and this would be the Schrödinger wave. In this, now, if you look at the, so this is Bush's John Bush results that I lost in the other slide. So these are individual trajectory of one particle in a circular cavity. So you remember that it is a very disordered trajectory. And you see a wave, and this wave has nothing to do with the eigenmode visually, has nothing to do with the eigenmode of the cavity. Yet, if you do the statistics, what you get is the eigenmode of the cavity. So this is very similar to De Broglie again. This would be the instantaneous wave associated with the particle, and this would be the Schrödinger wave. Now, in all of this, so OK, now I've come to my conclusion.
So do you get different eigenmodes by changing?
Yeah, you can change. This is what we are doing now. So the main, so this is the conclusion. The main drawback of this experiment is that it's extremely far from quantum mechanics. So it's a macroscopic scale. It has no relation with Planck constant whatsoever. It's two-dimensional. It's dissipative and sustained by an external forcing. The forcing imposes a fixed frequency. And finally, and this is the most problematic difference, is that the waves live on a material medium. So that there is an ether in this system, which is a liquid. Okay. Yes?
Isn't there another difference that you have a surface tension term, which is absent from the...
Yeah, but it doesn't really matter, because it enters in the propagation of waves in the wavelengths, and it doesn't enter for the drop. The drop is rigid and doesn't merge. So the surface tension doesn't act, in fact.
Okay,
so the main interest of this experiment, the main drawback is far from quantum mechanics, but the main interest of this experiment is the same. It's because it's far from quantum mechanics. Because in quantum mechanics, you have the Planck limitation that imposes itself to all possible measurements. So all the measurements that you can do in quantum mechanics are intrusive. They disturb what they aim to measure. In our experiment, we can do both. We can do either intrusive measurements or non-intrusive measurements. Because, for instance, if we put slit, then it's a way to measure. Suppose you can't see the cell. If you put a slit, you can measure where has the drop passed. So you know where it has passed. So it's a measurement of position. And then you have this uncertainty appearing. But then if you look at the system with light, light doesn't have any interaction with a phenomena, and therefore you can do non-intrusive measurement, and you can do non-intrusive measurement during intrusive measurements. And if you do so, you find that indeed the trajectories that are created by the intrusive measurement are chaotic. When you pass the system through a slit, during a very short period, the trajectory in the slit is chaotic. When you confine the system in a cavity, trajectory in the cavity is chaotic. So whenever you do an intrusive measurement, and this chaos makes the particle explore the space and generate eigenmodes of the space, of the geometry of the system. Okay, now all this, so finally, all these observed properties are all linked with what we have called the wave particle path memory. In all these experiments, maybe I was not clear enough, but if you do this experiment, for instance, in slits with a walker with no memory, nothing is observed. Same thing with cavities, same thing. All the phenomena that we observe that are wave-mediated memory.
Memory is like a tunable Planck's constant.
In our case, it's not a Planck constant, but it's a phenomenon that sort of generates this chaotic motion in the confined region.
You want to translate it to quantum mechanics.
No, Planck constant, the equivalent of Planck constant is, in fact, the equivalence is between De Broglie wavelengths and Faraday wavelengths. It's through this wavelength that you get the equivalence. So for the, so finally, I managed to put the word emerge. Thank you.
If you have, if you take two of these guys and they hang around together for a while and separate, you think their futures are going to be entangled by this wave mediator?
I don't know how to do it experimentally, but I would say yes. Well, let's put it that way. I'm not able to do it experimentally. Conceptually, if you have a long-term memory, I don't know how long it could be, but if you have a long-term memory, that means that the two systems can remain linked by the waves on a long time and in a non-local way. So I don't know, you know, it's a bit beyond my capability. But in all the experiments that we've tried, because we are able to do them, where you have some comparison to quantum mechanics, you find some relation.
Sorry, if you really wanted to do the analog of a test of Bell inequalities for this, you would have, so one thing that's crucial in such tests is that you, that no influence traveling at the speed of light or less can travel between the two systems. And you'd have to then decide what was the analog of the speed of light in your system.
Well, probably the equivalent of the speed of light is the speed of the waves. But on the other hand, maybe this, the thing is that it's a strange system, because we're in physics, we are used to having systems where you define the initial state and then you get the trajectory. Here, the system is not sensitive only to the initial state, it's sensitive to all the successive states because of the past memory. So the wave field contains a memory.
Sorry,
you know, it's like your life.
Why is that different from quantum mechanics?
No, I'm not saying it's different from quantum mechanics. I'm just saying that it makes it a strange system. Because you could have, you know, in this entanglement experiment that shown that it couldn't be linked with an initial, the simple transmission of an initial state. This that, you know, you could imagine that there you just have some memory of the initial separation between particles.
No, but a proper test would involve you changing the conditions in the experiment too rapidly for
the wave to react.
And then, so wouldn't you just get the same result as quantum mechanics, provided that you substituted the speed of the waves for the speed of light?
It's possible. I don't know. You know, so I'm sort of a bit careful, but it's not inconceivable. I think it's the system is strange enough can do that.
So you have to be close to the bifurcation point for this to happen, right?
The Faraday.
Yes. So what is the analog of that small parameter in quantum mechanics?
It's a very good question. I don't know. In quantum mechanics, in principle, it's non-dissipative. So you are you would be at threshold, and you would have some kind of infinite memory.
But I mean, does it control in some sense whether you're in the fully quantum or semi-classical limits?
I think it would control more like something like a coherent Snax. A coherent Snax. I don't think there is an exact equivalent, because this comes from the dissipative character of this system. So obviously in quantum mechanics, the limit would be very large, or maybe infinite memory.
Yeah.
And of course, this raises issues also on the energy in quantum mechanics, because in this case, if you have waves everywhere, where is the energy?
Yeah.
So,
People often ask why one does experiments if simulations can probe everything. You've done both experiments and simulations here. Which are more efficient? From which have you learned more?
You ask me. Of course, from experiment. It's fair to say that I think simulation is another way to do experiments. Experiments are more, I don't know how to say it, have more results that are unpredictable. Because usually in numerical simulation, you have strict limitation by the equation you have put in your simulation. So you can not have new physics coming in. You know? So we would not have found Walker's with simulation.
Okay, so there are lots of questions and not time. I'm going to take two more questions, so Lee, and then...
So when you say your system is tuned to be non-dissipative, there's a formulation of a hidden variable theory by the mathematician Nelson, where basically the combination of Brownian motion plus there being an average conserved energy for the motion of the particle results in something like quantum mechanics.
Okay, I didn't know. We have to discuss.
So maybe we can discuss.
Yeah.
Okay, then right to the very back.
Could you comment on the interactions? Because most of your talk was single particle physics, and then you showed like one slide where interaction changed from attractive to repulsive. And it looks like the interactions here are fixed by the properties of the waves themselves, right? So there's no independent parameter.
No, but you must remember that in this system, we have only one frequency of forcing. So all the particles that you put on the bath, they are synchronized by the forcing. So you cannot be in a situation where you would have particles with different velocities and different frequencies and that you would have in the real world. So that's the main one of the main. There are some experiments that you can do. You can create a cloud of this particle and look at their interaction. And the problem is that they tend to coalesce. And when they're too big, they don't work anymore, and then the whole thing collapses. So we have not studied that yet. We are going to do it because we found a trick to avoid the coalesce and so, with a short-range repulsion. We're going to use ferrofluid droplets. So we can maneuver these droplets more easily. But you see that you don't... The problem is this... With this fixed frequency, you have some kind of cross section of quantum mechanics.
Well, let's thank
Yves
again once again.